Well, it's a wonderful afterlife, isn't it? We're going to be talking with Rich Martini about his latest work on the afterlife. Get ready on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Rich Martini with us. He's written and directed 9 independent films, a former freelance journalist. After a dream vision of visiting his friend in the great beyond, Martini went on a literal quest to find out about the prevailing science and philosophical opinions on the afterlife. He journeyed into Tibetan philosophy. He made documentaries in Tibet. Eventually, he was introduced to the work of the Newton Institute, founded by renowned hypnotherapist Dr. Michael Newton. And Rich Martini is just one heck of a good guy, by the way. Rich, always a pleasure. Welcome back.
George, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And all, even more so just to hear you talk about me.
What's so, new with you?
Well, let's see. I presented a lot of my flipside research to these scientists over at the University of Virginia, Dr. Bruce Grayson, who's sort of the godfather of near-death experiences, as well as Jim Tucker, who wrote a fantastic book. I think he's been on the show.
Yep.
Return to Life. And Ed Kelly, Harvard professor, who studied a number of things, including Kundalini experiences. Anyway, I sat with them and they said, you know, Rich, science doesn't really consider these reports of afterlife experiences through hypnosis as valid science. And I said, well, of course, that's because you guys, the way you've been doing it, it's like an hour-long session, you know, the Freudian paradigm.
Yeah.
But in the Newton case, here's a guy who had done maybe 6-hour sessions and 7,000 people over 30 years. They all said the same things about the afterlife. But that question prompted me to expand the research into near-death experiences, which are studied by science, which Dr. Grayson actually did the initial studies that showed the hallmarks of the various experiences. And so I expanded the research into scientists who were talking about consciousness, Mario Beauregard, and Gary Schwartz, of course, has been on the show. And I interviewed these guys, as well as spoke to a number of people who had near-death experiences, and I convinced them to have a between-life session so they could re-examine the events that happened. You know, when a person has a near-death experience, they come back and you say, well, what was it like? And they'll say, well, I saw these things, but I can't remember. I you know, it's kind of hard for me to focus. And under hypnosis, you can focus. So I've expanded the research into that, and now I'm focusing on what I like to call new information. And that's where during a session, during a hypnosis session or during a near-death experience, someone sees or experiences or hears something that they couldn't possibly know while they're on the planet. You know, science calls the memory of past lives as cryptomnesia, meaning, you know, you heard it or saw it or read it or a TV was on, you know, in the next room, and you heard some of these.
You're right, and your brain sucks it in somehow.
Right. Somehow you transmuted it into your memory of a past life. Well, what about cases where people learn new things while they're on the flip side? And I've been focusing on that. So let me just give you a couple examples. You know, Dr. Eben Alexander, I'm sure he's probably been on the show.
He's been on. Absolutely.
And, you know, a fantastic journey that he went to on the flip side. But during his journey, he remembered meeting a woman who he instantly recognized, but he had never met in his lifetime, but he felt like he knew her. And she sort of guided him around this afterlife experience, this near-death experience. But it wasn't until many months later, after he had recovered, that he got a letter from the family that had put him up for adoption. He had been adopted. And the family sent him a photograph of his sister, someone who he had never met, didn't know existed. And the picture was of the same woman that he saw in his afterlife experience.
Oh, I love that. I love that.
Also in Colton Burpo's case, you know, Heaven is for Real. You know, Todd Burpo wrote that book about his son's experience on the flip side. Even in that case, he says he met his sister while he was over there. And when he came back, he said to his parents, how come you didn't tell me I had a sister? And, of course, they had never told him that he had a sister who died in childbirth, something he wouldn't mention to a 5-year-old. But he knew that because he experienced new information while he was there. And even in my case, when my dear father passed away, That night, I went back home to my ancestral home in Chicago, not too far from Detroit, by the way.
That's right,
and
yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Where you grew up. But the night that I was back home, I had the experience of my father waking me up, shook my shoulder, and I heard him say, "I'm experiencing indescribable joy," which is a wonderful thing to hear because Alzheimer's had robbed him of his voice for about 4 years, and to hear him so clearly in my ear was startling. But then he said, "I need you to write something down." And I woke up, you know, got a pen and a pencil and turned the light on, so I was pretty awake. And then I turned the light off because I thought, well, maybe that helps communication or something. And he gave me a list of things. But first he said, "Tell your mother I love her. I'm here with Mom and Papa." And he named a number of people who had passed away, my uncle and other people. But then he said, "I'm here with Pat so-and-so and Jim." And he named about six people whose names I'd never heard before, but I just wrote them down as I heard them. And the next day, I asked my mom, "You know, did you ever hear Dad say something like indescribable joy?" And she said, "Very rarely he'd say something that was indescribably beautiful." I said, "Okay, well, here's this message I got from him." And then I said, "But here, who are these six people?" And she said, "Oh, those are all his friends who died in World War II. People I never heard of, could not have heard of, had no experience with." So you find these things often in these accounts of, and, you know, we just aren't used to looking for the new information part. But I'll give you an example. My dear cousin lost her son about a year ago, and he came to, I asked her, "Has he ever come to visit you or you had an experience with him?" And she said, "Well, not really, except for a dream." Came to her in a dream. And in the dream, the experience was that they were at a party, like at their home, the place she grew up. And so it was like a happy experience. And then she looked over and there was her son. And she went over to him and said, "Oh, where are you? How are you?" And he said, "I'm fine, Mom. I'm good." And she said, "But how do I connect to you?" And he said, "Just look at the pictures." So she said that to me, like, "What does that mean?" And I said, "Well, it's interesting because in these cases that I've studied and researched, often people say that photographs, which are, I guess you'd call it some kind of like a holographic piece of time, you know, when you take a picture, you're actually taking a slice of time because
that's
of the
right.
magnet, you know, the way it's magnetized on the paper, et cetera, et cetera. I guess that's why it works this way. But what people say is that for them, for those people on the flip side, it's easier for them to communicate with us through something like a photograph, because as we sit in front of it, we kind of create them in our mind's eye, create their energetic pattern. And for them, it's easier for them to reach out to us. And as I was saying this to her, a woman came by and said, "Oh, I've heard the same thing. When my son died, he told me in a dream, just speak out loud." So there you have it, the idea of, you want to contact someone who passed away. Look, it's just an experiment. Take a photograph of them, think, picture them in present tense, and ask them a question or talk to them out loud. Of course, the joke is when you go to church and you pray to God out loud, everyone calls that religion, but when God responds, they call that insanity.
Yeah.
So,
or a miracle, who knows?
Or
huh?
A miracle, exactly. But that's what I've been sort of focusing on is hearing people's stories about, you know, an event that happened. And when someone tells me that someone passed away, I'll ask that question privately. You know, have you had any experience or dreams or anything? I'll tell you this really wild report that I got from an attorney practicing in a Western state, let's just say. She said that she's been an attorney for 30 years representing killers, second-degree murderers.
Oh, God, criminal attorney.
Criminal attorney. And, you know, second-degree murder meaning like a drunk driver or, you know, somebody doing something goofy. And
manslaughter cases,
exactly.
Things like that.
Exactly. And she had read my book, Flipside, and contacted me and said that in her experience, every one of her clients had said at some point that they were visited by the victim, the person they had killed. And that when they visited them, either in a dream or physically in a manifestation of, you know, at the end of the bed as a ghost, the person would say something along the lines of, I'm okay, and I can help you. And when I first heard that, you know, it made my brain swim. But I said, well, are you talking about how many cases, like 5 or 10? She said, no, all of them.
That's amazing. Wow.
And I said, well, so then you mean these people would come to you and tell you the story? And she said, yes, there's no one else you could tell. You can't tell the judge, you can't tell the parents, you can't tell anyone that, you know, this terrible accident that happened, let's say, in one case she described, because she gave me 4 cases I could look up, find out if it was accurate. But in one case, this guy had been, you know, he just was drunk driving, and he decided to go around a truck and ran over this poor kid on a bike. And the kid started appearing to him daily. And he'd only seen him for an instant, but now here he was hearing him talk and seeing him, you know, seeing the kid. And so he went to his attorney and told her, and it, of course, it freaked him out. He had no...
Was he haunted, or just these were visitations?
He was haunted. He was completely haunted, and I think in this guy's case, he became an alcoholic. He couldn't handle it. Now, oddly enough, just about a month ago in Seattle, this guy killed a family, and, you know, this is hard information to pass along, and it's just data. I'm just trying to say, look, I'm doing this research, but in this particular case in Seattle, this guy had killed a whole family. And they found him guilty, and they were in the sentencing phase, and they asked him, do you want to say anything? And he said, yeah, I'd like to say that the family came to visit me, and they basically said, I'm okay, and they can help me. And, of course, in the courtroom, everybody was in an uproar, like, well, you know, how dare you? But, you know, this guy, his name was McEnroe, and he said that... The victims had visited him from the afterlife, and quote, they aren't as mad as you'd think. So, I don't know. It's, you know, when you're gathering data about something that's unusual like this, when you hear stories, and of course it fits into what I've been researching in the other areas, which is that when you get back to the between lives realm, there's no one standing in judgment of you but yourself. You examine why you chose this lifetime. You examine the things that you did in this lifetime. If you've done bad things or things that hurt people, you get to re-experience those things. But ultimately, you're the person who has to decide if you learned anything, or if you have to come back and do it again, or if somehow you have to live a lifetime that will right the wrong that you committed, you see? So... I don't know. It's just a fascinating turn of events, and that's kind of what I've been focusing on. Is
have you heard anything of those victims who have been brutally murdered in first-degree cases, not second-degree or manslaughter? Have they come back, too, and basically made that killer feel better?
Well, in this case, that was a first-degree murder, this guy, this McEnroe guy in Seattle. And so he had killed people deliberately. And he didn't know how to handle the, you know, the context of it. Here he was being sentenced to death, I guess. I don't know what his final sentence was. But he was just trying to say to the parents, because the prosecuting attorney said, wait a second, are you saying that your victims came back to visit you and that's what they told you? And it was just a verification of what I had heard from this other attorney.
How do we know he wasn't making that up, Rich?
Oh, no, we have no idea. Absolutely have no idea. And, you know, but it's not like he read it in a book somewhere, because it's so, you know, beyond the pale of what you would imagine people to say. But I'm just saying, you know, this attorney brought this to my attention, and I understand it in the context of what people say about the afterlife, that when a terrible tragedy happens, fill in the blank, from 9/11 to Cambodia to, you know, China and Stalin, millions of people die in these kind of epic events. Well, listen, when we get to this concept that people don't die, that's what the research shows. People do not die. So when they're back home, as everyone has called it in all of the sessions that I've filmed 25 so far, and every time the hypnotherapist will say, where do you want to go? And they'll say, I want to go home. When you get back home and you reconnect with your soul group and your loved ones, they talk to you about your lifetime. They go, oh, you did such a great job. You helped so many people. It's a shame you didn't get to do the thing that you kind of wanted to do here, but you did a wonderful job. And if you look at it as something like a classroom or or a stage performance, you know, that we sign up for 10,000 performances. Each one, we get to go back and hear what people thought of our performance, and we get to examine it ourselves. So if you start with the premise that we don't die, then therefore there's nothing that anyone can do to harm you, first degree, second degree, third degree. It's stressful for everybody else, of course, your loved ones who are missing you. That's no question about that. But for you personally, when you get back to the flip side, you're back home. Not so stressful.
No. It's amazing what's going on the other side. Have you concluded what this all is, Rich?
Well, I love Roger Ebert's quote. Just prior to his death, you know, he was in the hospital.
Oh, my God.
He wrote a note to his wife, Chaz.
He had jaw cancer and everything else.
Yeah. Well, two things. One is he died while he was in the hospital. And his wife came in, and the doctors were like, you know, I'm sorry he died. And then she heard him say, I'm not dead. You need to tell them to revive me. And so she did. She made them revive him. And he wrote about it, because he lived another 4 or 5 years. So he wrote about it, and he said, I had this experience. My wife says that I spoke to her. Of course, he didn't believe in the afterlife, so he said, I don't know how that happened. You know, which is kind of funny when you think about it. Here's the woman he loves the most in the world. She verifies exactly that there is consciousness outside of death, but he can't really conceive of it himself.
He can't.
But anyway, so there's this moment later on, about 3 or 4 years later, where she comes in and sees him in bed, and he's written 5 words on a piece of paper. And the 5 words are, it's all an elaborate hoax. Which I thought was pretty funny. I've met Roger, you know, a few times in my film career. You know, he gave me thumbs way down once for one of my films. But, you know, here's a guy who spent his life, you know, crafting words. He could have said, it's all an elaborate movie, which would have been more in telling, you know, about his world.
About his world, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, but, you know, calling something a hoax implies somebody's trying to pull something over on you.
Trickery, all that
trickery
stuff.
Exactly. But, you know, when you're in the middle of a football game and you're playing on the field and somebody runs onto the field and goes, this is all a game. It doesn't really mean anything. It's just a game. You know, you're like, who is that? Please sit down in the stands. We're in the middle, you know, it's 3rd and 9. I can't hear that it's the game. Or I'm fond of saying, you know, I'm the guy running around the stage going, it's a play. We're all in a play. You know, who wants to hear that guy? You know, get off stage, buddy. So saying it's an elaborate hoax, okay, that's one way to put it. Somebody else might say it's an elaborate simulation. Okay, well, I like that. That's pretty cool. How about it's an elaborate carnival that we're all participating in, and some of it's hilarious. Some of it's fantastic. Most of it's fantastic. Most of it is just this kind of unbelievable bliss because we get to look at sunsets. We get to have cappuccinos. We get to do all these great things that we signed up to do, you know, and we're here doing them. And, of course, we spend so much time, you know, complaining about it, or as a friend of mine said, whining in our Cheerios. You know, we don't see that. Oh, wow, we signed up for this incredible adventure, and we're not really enjoying it, are we? You know, we're stuck in our cell phones walking down the street texting when you could just look up and see, you know, the most magnificent sunset that ever happened. You know what I mean?
When this all hit you and you really started believing in it, was there one major event for you?
Yes, there was, It was when Michael Newton suggested that I try one of these between-life hypnotherapy sessions. And I...
That did it.
Well, at first I thought, you know, this is a great way for me to disprove this. Because as a skeptic, as we should all be, you know, here's a guy who said that over the course of 30 years, 7,000 people said the same things about the afterlife. Well, how could that be? So when they offered me one, I thought, this is great. I'm not trying to find another lifetime. I'm going to prove this is fake.
Hold on, Rich. Let's find out a little bit more about that when we come right back as we talk about the afterlife right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we've got a television program that deals with a lot of subjects, including the afterlife. Some great shows out there. Just simply go to this website and look at the previews at beyondbelief.com, www.beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast, Rich Martini with us. We'll take some phone calls, maybe even some of your stories when we come back. There's no question in my mind now, Rich, that the afterlife is something, it exists. And I finally got convinced of it by just looking at the wonders of life. It's just obvious that there's got to be something else.
Well, that's an interesting way or an interesting perspective. I mean, I think everyone has to come to their own apotheosis about, you know, whether there is one or not, of course. In my case, you know, doing a session with a Michael Newton-trained hypnotherapist, for me, felt like I took the red pill. Suddenly, the whole entire view of the planet shifted, not like a huge amount, but like just like the axis was tilted. It's like everything suddenly had a different hue or a different tone to it. Now, some people have a near-death experience. Some people maybe are visited by someone. But in my case, I've had four different of these LBLs or between life sessions. And in each one, I've gone to visit my friend who was the impetus for this research, who she came to visit me. And I thought, well, if it's possible that my friend is still alive and appearing to me in these dreams, then it must be that she is somewhere and I could find a way to go visit her. So this became a method that I could visit my friend. And each time I've seen her and talked to her, held her hand, looked her in the eye, and had that experience, which only I know of. Only I can really know what that experience is like, holding a loved one's hand, my loved one, you see. So for people who are suffering that want to connect with someone who's no longer on the planet, this is one way you can do it. I call it a near-death experience without the near-death part. You know, so that's just one way that I've done it. And, you know, just in terms of being able to meet with people that are no longer on the planet, like you say, you know, whether it's a belief in the flip side or a belief in the afterlife, it appears that the veil is thinning. And I think people like you are doing this service to the planet where you talk about something. I mean, have you ever heard of the overview effect?
Tell me.
That's the thing where astronauts, when they come back from traveling around in outer space for a long time, they no longer see the planet in terms of borders. They no longer see people in terms of their race, gender, et cetera, et cetera. They're just people.
Everything changes for them.
Everything changes. The perspective changes. And so, you know, it's that pale blue dot that Carl Sagan talked about. You know, even Chelsea Manning said that the reason that she was inspired to, you know, reveal secrets about the war was based on looking at the pale blue dot photograph, seeing the planet as a complete place. And once you start to see the planet as this living organism that we all inhabit, that we're all equal, that there are no borders, you also see this on the flip side. There is no hierarchy. Everyone's equal over there. That's what everyone reports, and that's the experience of it. So, but this idea that the veil is thinning, my wife tried to do one of those classes where they kind of, you know, help you work on your mediumship, you know, your ability to do stuff. And so in her first class, she came with a photograph of my dad who had passed away. And you hand the photograph to somebody else, and in the course of the class, this somebody else said, oh, this man is an architect, and he's talking about a red knife that he gave his son. So she came home and told me about that, and I was thinking, red knife? I don't know what Dad would... He was an architect, yeah. So I emailed my brother.
Oh, that's amazing all by itself.
All by itself, exactly. Yeah. But it's even better because I emailed my brother, and he sent me a photograph of the red knife that my dad had given him. So that was very specific, you know, this red Swiss Army knife that my dad had. Of course, every father's probably given his son.
But, a red Swiss Army knife.
Right. But my wife then took in a photograph of her former boss, who was a pretty famous attorney here in Los Angeles. He had passed away, a DA. And what happened was, in the class, this woman started talking about this guy as an attorney and said he goes for jogs with his wife, his widow, every day, and described the street and everything that that they lived on, and my wife knew that.
But he's dead, right?
He's dead, exactly. Yeah. And so then the teacher of the class asked him, why are you coming through so clearly? And his reply was, because the veil is thinning. So he's talking about an active thing of a thinning veil between us and them. And I think the reason for
that is... That's interesting. And he's aware of it.
And he's aware of it. And the reason I think it's thinning is because we're talking about this stuff. Stuff that normally people, well, normally, used to be crucified for, or, you know, burned at the stake.
That's right.
Or, dismissed. People are talking about it now because of the internet, and they're sharing real experiences, stuff that happened to them. You know, they could throw it all out in the wash and say, well, this isn't science, it's anecdotes or whatever they want to say. But ultimately, if it happened to you, like my experiences, you start to own it. You start to believe it. And I think you're doing this service to the planet by talking about this stuff. It reduces whatever you want to call the filters that prevent us from accessing this information. You know, Bruce Grayson and Mario Beauregard both talk about these filters in their research about consciousness, how, you know, people who've died and seen themselves, you know, while the operating room is happening. Or in Dr. Grayson's case, he talks about, he's got a great YouTube video called Is Consciousness Produced by the Brain, where he talks about Alzheimer's patients who suddenly regain all their memory just moments or hours or sometimes days before they pass, and it's like they have access to everything. And then when they die, they do the autopsy, and the brain should not have been able to remember that stuff. It's a phenomenon that's been happening worldwide. In the UK, he says that 70% of the healthcare Alzheimer's cases reported something like this. But what he thinks is that the filters themselves that prevent us from accessing the afterlife have died along with the brain because they're built into the brain. And so when the brain is dying, those filters become less. And so you're able to access consciousness that isn't tied to your brain, isn't created by your brain.
Okay. And a lot of people, Rich, I think made the mistake of tying the physical brain with all these events that were going on. Whether you're skeptical or not, they always felt without the brain, none of this would exist.
Exactly. That is,
and that's not the truth. That's not the case.
It's not in the research, or it's not in the data. Let's just put it that way. I'm sure you're aware of Dr. Sam Parnia's AWARE project. And
sure
in
am.
Some of those cases, people who were born blind at birth, saw colors while they were floating around the operating room, came back and told the doctor about his orange tennis shoes. These kinds of cases prove that consciousness isn't confined to the brain. It may be, you know, a certain amount of it is obviously created by the brain, but it's not confined. Anyway, I'm just saying in my research, talking to people on the flip side, whether through a near-death experience that they've had talking about that, or they then have a between-life session where they can revisit it, they examine what it's like flying around in another realm with your consciousness. And I found this really interesting phenomenon where when I'm interviewing somebody who's had a near-death experience, I found that if I just ask pointed questions about the experience, they start to remember it while they're talking to me. They're not under hypnosis. They're not closing their eyes. Their eyes are open. I did an interview with David Bennett. I don't know if you've had David on yet, but he wrote this terrific book, Voyage of Purpose, and he was a science officer aboard a ship, had a near-death experience. He drowned. And in the near-death experience, he not only saw a life review and the things you'd normally see, he also saw that in the future, he was going to get cancer and survive it. Okay? And at some point, 20, 30 years later, when he was in a doctor's office, a new doctor came in, and he recognized the guy from his near-death experience. And when the guy said, we've looked at your charts, I'm really sorry to tell you, you only have 6 weeks to live, David Bennett said, no, actually, I survived this because I've seen this already. And the doctor said, no, you're in denial. You're not going to survive this. Well, he did, and he wrote this book. So I interview him on YouTube. If you just look up my name and David Bennett's name, there's this hour-long interview. And in the midst of the interview, I ask him to re-access those memories. And it's interesting to watch him say, oh, I see. I didn't see that before. So what I'm saying is not only is the veil thinning between the afterlife and our life, it's the whatever these filters are, they seem to be lessening the more we talk about this stuff, if that makes any sense.
If and when that time comes and you go, would you prefer to stay in that enlightened moment or come back and be reincarnated?
That's funny. Well, of course, I'm fond of saying we don't really go. It's just we're not here. It's like walking through a door. In my case, I've experienced that journey because I had a past life regression and I remembered what a previous lifetime was like, and then I went to the end of that life and I had the experience of traveling back home and seeing my loved ones and seeing my soul group, and I'm seeing my council and seeing classrooms and seeing all these things that people report. So I've had the physical experience in my consciousness now, and now I've done it four times. So I've experienced that each time. So I kind of already know what the journey's like. It's kind of like let's make a trip to the Himalayas, but we're going to go with a Sherpa who's been there many, many times. So since I've been already, I kind of know what the physical experience is going to be like. So it really, I don't think it'll be a surprise. I mean, it'll be a surprise if it's the opposite.
Well, this is what I've always told people, Rich, and that is when they ask me, do you believe in the afterlife? And I say, yeah, I do. But I preface it by saying, if I'm wrong and it doesn't exist, I'm not going to know about it anyway, so it doesn't matter.
That's very good. Well, what I try to point to is, so in this kind of architecture of the afterlife, where we're talking to people who are remembering their life planning session, okay? And in many cases where somebody sits down with loved ones and they say, okay, at some point we're going to meet and we're going to fall in love and we're going to have kids. Now, who wants to play my kids? And there's a person in your soul group who goes, okay, I'll do it again, or whatever that is. But this life planning session that many, many cases, many people talk about, you can examine it in your own life today if it's true that there is a life planning session.
If it's true, that's right.
Exactly. And so when I say to you, George, I want you to go to the moment when you met your wife with your, the wife of your children,
mm-hmm.
when you first met her, when did you really have the conscious feeling that you were going to be with her?
I was in high school. I was a kid. She was a kid. But
okay,
at that moment, I figured, hey, you know what? I don't want to date anybody else anymore.
Well, okay, but hold on. So go to the moment that you had that thought when you saw her, because of course you saw her in class, and there was a lot of other girls in class, but there was something different about this particular one. And there was a moment in your relationship somewhere where you went, oh, she's the one, as opposed to that girl she's sitting next to with the red hair or whatever. but there is that moment.
There's that connection.
That's right. And when I ask people to examine it, I'll give you an example. My sister-in-law, who has five kids, I said, so when did you know? She said, oh, I still don't know. And I said, oh, come on. And then we pinpointed that on the second date, while they were having dinner together, she said, something about the look in his eyes and the sound of his voice made me feel like I was home. Now, everybody has a different idea of what home is, but in that moment, she felt that security, almost like a reconnection of who this person is. Now, when I asked him the same question, he said, well, I walked into a classroom and I looked at her and I said to myself, oh, there's my wife. So it wasn't even a conscious thought, you see. It happened so fast, he didn't have time to go.
Well, what causes that? What causes that kind of connection?
Because you've seen them before. You've been with them before. You've been possibly in a life planning session with that person where you said, well, I'll give you an example. After I read this research, it was in Michael Newton's books, and I was like, what? Are you kidding me? People plan their lives? That's insane. Of course we have free will, so you can screw things up all along the way. The girl you're supposed to meet, she keeps getting on the bus and leaving. That happens. But in my case, I had to then, examine myself. So then I remembered, oh my gosh, I was sitting in a Starbucks in Santa Monica, and I looked over at this young woman who had a necklace on, and her necklace caught my eye, like a mirror you know, flashing in your face. And so now I'm staring at this necklace, like, what the heck is that? And then I start talking to this woman. And at first I thought, I can't even tell how old she is. Maybe if I start asking her questions, I'll figure this out. Anyway, within a few minutes, I said to her, why don't we just skip down, get married, and have a couple of kids? And as I said it, I was thinking, what? What did you just say? I had never said anything like, of course, my wife says, I say that to everybody at Starbucks. But in this particular case, I saw that moment. Now, it took us a couple of years to get together, but that necklace caught my eye, and looking at her face, I couldn't tell even what age she was. It was so indeterminate. So I had to experience myself. Let's just call it that. And when I ask people about that moment, I hear the weirdest answers. I had one woman say, well, I felt nauseous. And I said, why? She said, because I knew I'd never be with another man. And I've heard all kinds of, you know, variations of that, of guys. My brother, he was in a bar in Chicago, and he saw like a light over this woman's head. The way, you know, he doesn't believe in any of this stuff, you know, and it's like Greek to him. But I asked him that question. He said, well, you know, it was weird because I saw this girl at the bar and there was a light around her. And so I went over and I started talking to her and I said, oh yeah, of course I know her. Well, of course they got married and had, you know, three kids. It's just examining the moment when the significant person in your life, even if you don't stay together, but there's something dramatic that happens between you, that deja vu, I feel like I've known this person forever. Just examine it. That's all I'm saying.
Well, it's a remarkable tool, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's, well, it gives us, what I'm saying is you're looking at evidence of the afterlife, just like you said, when you look around yourself, when you examine it. So, you know, you walk into a room and somebody perks their head up and they go, I feel like I've known you forever. Forget that they've seen you on, you know, television, on the radio.
Yeah.
But you go over there and you hold their hand, you shake their hand. This happened to me once in London. I met this professor, this Oxford professor, and I shook his hand, and some voice somewhere said, this is why you're in London. And I kind of, you know, clocked it like, okay, what was that, you know? Who is this guy? I should really get to know him. And we became friends. And email friends. And about 6 months later, he wrote to me this tragic email that his daughter had died.
Oh, gosh.
And so I wrote to him and said, you know, I'm so sorry. And I'd been reading Carol Bowman's book, Children's Past Lives. I thought that would be helpful.
She's great, by the way.
Oh, yeah, terrific. And she studied with Michael Newton. But anyway, this guy, Robert Beer, said to me, have you ever heard of Michael Newton? And so then I started my documentary about him. And then when I had a session, I called him up and I said, you know, this is going to sound really weird, but I think you can connect with your daughter if you do one of these sessions. So he wrote to me afterwards this unbelievable email where he spent an hour holding his daughter's hand in one of these between life sessions. She had passed away. It was a year later. But he said, beyond a shadow of a doubt, he had the physical experience of looking at his daughter, and she explained to him why she had to leave, why this was the time for her to leave in this lifetime. There's another really interesting point in this case, which is...
Hold on, Robert, right there, Rich. Hold on. We're already at the top of the hour, but we'll come back and talk more and take phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.